cluttered corridor, he flung open a tightly sealed door, and I was hit squarely in the face, first by a blast of white, white light, then by a stink so powerful it felt like a punch. Sweaty, vegetal, and sulfurous, the place might have been a locker room in the Amazon. After my eyes adjusted to the light, I stepped into a windowless chamber not much bigger than a walk-in closet, crammed with electrical equipment, snaked with cables and plastic tubing, and completely sealed off from the world. More than half the room was taken up by the gardener's sea of green. A 6-foot square table invisible beneath a jungle of dark, serrated leaves oscillating gently in an artificial breeze. There were perhaps 100 clones here, each barely a foot tall, yet already sending forth a thick finger of hairy calyxes, casting about vainly for a few grains of airborne pollen. A network of narrow plastic pipes supplied the plants with water. A tank of CO2 sweetened their air. A ceramic heater warmed their roots at night, and 4 600-watt sodium fixtures bathed them in a blaze of light for 12 hours of every day. The other 12, they were sealed in perfect darkness. The briefest lapse of light, the gardener informed me gravely, would ruin the whole crop. There was nothing of beauty in this garden. Should legalization ever come, no one is going to grow cannabis for the prettiness of its flowers, those hairy, sweaty-smelling, dandruff clumps. There was also something bizarrely anomalous about this totalitarian hothouse, with its strict monoculture of genetically identical plants growing in lockstep. Such ferocious Apollonian control in a garden ostensibly devoted to Dionysus. Yet, to a gardener, there was much in this claustrophobic chamber to admire. I don't think I've ever seen plants that looked more enthusiastic. This, despite the fact that they were being forced to grow in an utterly unnatural, even perverted manner. Overbred, overfed, overstimulated, sped up, and pygmied all at once. Happy to oblige, the marijuana plants seemed to say, sucking up the CO2, gorging themselves on the fertilizers, guzzling down the water, and throwing themselves at bulbs so hot and bright I finally had to look away. In exchange for a regimen of encouragement the likes of which few plants have ever known, these 100 eager, demonic dwarves would oblige their gardener with 3 pounds of dried buds before the month was out. Some $13,000 worth of flowers. It was all more than a little mad, and very soon I was counting the minutes before I could politely make my exit and draw an ordinary breath. On the train back to Amsterdam, I tried to make some sense of this particular madness. It had a rather notorious local precedent, of course, an episode of equally intense involvement with a particular plant. During the tulipomania that briefly bewitched this city, the last time flowers traded for such fortunes, gardeners would exert themselves with a similar obsessiveness, rigging their precious plants with burglar alarms, deploying mirrors to multiply their blooms, and utterly failing to notice as their world shrank to the dimensions of a fevered dream. One could argue that the fevered dream was the same then as now, and certainly visions of wealth have underwritten both the 17th century tulip and 21st century marijuana flower. Yet in the case of the tulip, by the end there was nothing but wealth to fuel the madness, and that surely is not the case with these other, uglier flowers. The buds are homely, turd-like things, spangly with resin. Tulipomania may have had as its spring the human desire for exotic visual pleasure, for beauty, but that didn't last. Beauty eventually gave way to status as the desire that drove otherwise rational people to navigate their lives by the pole star of this plant. And by the end, pure financial speculation had hollowed out even that desire, so that no one noticed when the flowers were replaced by mere promises of themselves. The words on the paper of a futures contract. The madness in the marijuana garden is of a different order. Though it too is abundantly watered by money, it remains deeply rooted in the human desire for pleasure. In whatever exactly it is that the chemicals produced in these flowers can do to a person's conscious experience. This desire must be an exceptionally powerful one. The passion and the price this flower commands have proven as much, as perhaps does the force of its taboo. Yet, for my part, I realized I didn't understand the first thing about that desire. Not really. So what exactly is the knowledge held out by these plants, and why has it been so strenuously forbidden? With the solitary exception of the Eskimos, there isn't a people on Earth who doesn't use psychoactive plants to effect a change in consciousness, and there probably never has been. As for the Eskimos, their exception only proves the rule. Historically, Eskimos didn't use psychoactive plants because none of them will grow in the Arctic. As soon as the white man introduced the Eskimo to fermented grain, he immediately joined the consciousness changers. What this suggests is that the desire to alter one's experience of consciousness may be universal. Nor is the desire limited to adults. Andrew Weil, who has written two valuable books treating consciousness changing as a basic human activity, points out that even young children seek out altered states of awareness. They will spin until violently dizzy, thereby producing visual hallucinations, deliberately hyperventilate, throttle one another to the point of fainting, inhale any fumes they can find, and, on a daily basis, seek the rush of energy supplied by processed sugar, sugar being the child's plant drug of choice. As the examples from childhood suggest, using drugs is not the only way to achieve altered states of consciousness. Activities as different as meditation, fasting, exercise, amusement park rides, horror movies, extreme sports, sensory or sleep deprivation, chanting, music, eating spicy foods, and taking extreme risks of all kinds have the power to change the texture of our mental experience to one degree or another. We may eventually discover that what psychoactive plants do to the brain closely resembles, at a biochemical level, the effects of these other activities. Human cultures vary widely in the plants they use to gratify the desire for a change of mind, but all cultures, save the Eskimo, sanction at least one such plant and, just as invariably, strenuously forbid certain others. Along with the temptation seems to come the taboo. The reasons for drawing the bright line here and not there generally make more sense within the culture itself, rooted as they are in its values and traditions, than they do outside it. But the reasons cultures give for promoting one plant and forbidding another are remarkably fluid in both time and space. One culture's panacea is often another culture's panopathogen, root of all evil. Think of the traditional role of alcohol in the Christian West as compared to the Islamic East. Indeed, one culture's panacea can, over time, transmogrify into that same culture's panopathogen, as happened to opiates in the West between the 19th and 20th centuries. Tobacco smoking and coffee drinking were taboo in the West before the Industrial Revolution. The German historian Wolfgang Schievelsbusch suggests that the two drugs became socially acceptable because they aided in industrialization's reorientation of the human organism to the primacy of mental labor. Historians can explain these shifts much better than scientists can, since they usually have less to do with the intrinsic nature of the various molecules involved than with the powers that cultures ascribe to them and the changing needs of those cultures. Cannabis in American culture has at various times held the power to foster violence in the 1930s and indolence today. Same molecule, opposite effect. Promoting certain plant drugs and forbidding others may just be something cultures do as a way of defining themselves or reinforcing their cohesion. It's hardly surprising that something as magical as a plant with the power to alter people's feelings and thoughts would inspire both fetishes and taboos. What is harder to comprehend is why virtually all people, and more than a few animals, should have acquired such a desire in the first place. What good, from an evolutionary standpoint, could it do a creature to consume psychoactive plants? Possibly none at all. It's a fallacy to assume that whatever is that way for a good Darwinian reason. Just because a desire or practice is widespread or universal doesn't necessarily mean it confers an evolutionary edge. In fact, the human penchant for drugs may be the accidental byproduct of two completely different adaptive behaviors. This, at least, is the theory Steven Pinker proposes in How the Mind Works. He points out that evolution has endowed the human brain with two formerly unrelated faculties: its superior problem-solving abilities and an internal system of chemical rewards, such that when a person does something especially useful or heroic, the brain is washed in chemicals that make it feel good. Bring the first of these faculties to bear on the second, and you wind up with a creature who has figured out how to use plants to artificially trip the brain's reward system. But doing so is not necessarily good for us. Ronald Siegel, the animal intoxication expert, has shown that animals who get high on plants tend to be more accident-prone, more vulnerable to predators, and less likely to attend to their offspring. Intoxication is dangerous. But this only deepens the mystery. Why does the desire to alter consciousness remain powerful in the face of these perils? Or, put another way, why hasn't this desire simply died out, a casualty of Darwinian competition, the survival of the soberest? The Greeks understood that the answer to most either-or questions about intoxicants, and a great many other of life's mysteries, is both. Dionysus's wine is both a scourge and a blessing. Used with care and in the proper context, many drug plants do confer advantages on the creatures that consume them. Fiddling with one's brain chemistry can be very useful indeed. The relief of pain, a blessing of many psychoactive plants, is only the most obvious example. Plant stimulants, such as coffee, coca, and khat, help people to concentrate and work. Amazonian tribes take specific drugs to help them hunt, enhancing their endurance, eyesight, and strength. There are psychoactive plants that uncork inhibitions, quicken the sex drive, muffle or fire aggression, and smooth the waters of social life. Still others relieve stress, help people sleep or stay awake, and allow them to withstand misery or boredom. All these plants are, at least potentially, mental tools. People who know how to use them properly may be able to cope with everyday life better than those who don't. These are the easy cases, though, the plants that merely inflect the prose of everyday life without rewriting it. Transparent is a term used to characterize drugs whose effects on consciousness are too subtle to interfere with one's ability to get through the day and fulfill one's obligations. Drugs such as coffee, tea, and tobacco in our culture, or coca and khat leaves in others, leave the user's space-time coordinates untouched. But what about the more powerful plants, the ones that do alter the experience of space and time in such a way as to take users out of everyday life, out of even themselves? Cultures tend to be more wary of these plants, and for good reason. They pose a threat to the smooth workings of the social order. This may be why most complex, modern, secular societies have seen fit to forbid them. Even the cultures that endorse these plants cloak them in elaborate rules and rituals as a way of containing or disciplining their powers. So what are these powers, and what commends them, not only to adventurous individuals in all societies, but, in some cases, to their societies as well? For many cultures have held these plants to be sacred. No one has yet written the natural history of world religion, but we have some idea of the stories such a book would tell. Among other things, it would force us to rethink the relation of matter and spirit, specifically plant matter and human spirituality. For it would tell of how a select group of psychoactive plants and fungi, among them the peyote cactus, the Amanita muscaria and psilocybin mushrooms, the ergot fungus, the fermented grape, ayahuasca, and cannabis, were present at the creation of several of the world's religions. One of the world's earliest known religions was the cult of Soma, practiced by the ancient Indo-Europeans of Central Asia. According to its sacred text, the Rig Veda, Soma was an intoxicant with the powers of a god. People worshipped the drug itself, which ethnobotanists now think was Amanita muscaria, the mushroom sometimes known as fly agaric, as a path to divine knowledge. Much the same process took place again and again all over the ancient world as people experimented, individually and in groups, with the power of plants to transcend the here and now and induce ecstasy, to take them elsewhere. What these peoples discovered was that certain plants or fungi, ethnobotanists call them entheogens, meaning the god within, opened a door onto another world. The images and words brought back from these journeys, visits with the souls of the dead and unborn, visions of the afterlife, answers to life's questions, were powerful enough to compel belief in a spirit world and, in some cases, to serve as the foundation of whole religions. Of course, plant drugs are not the only technologies of religious ecstasy. Fasting, meditation, and hypnotic trances can achieve similar results. But often these techniques have been used to explore spiritual territory first blazed by the entheogens. What a natural history of religion would show is that the human experience of the divine has deep roots in psychoactive plants and fungi. Karl Marx may have gotten it backward when he called religion the opiate of the people. This is not to diminish anyone's religious beliefs. To the contrary, that certain plants summon spiritual knowledge is precisely what many religious people have believed, and who's to say that belief is wrong? Psychoactive plants are bridges between the worlds of matter and spirit, or, to update the vocabulary, chemistry and consciousness. What a trick this is for a plant, to produce a chemical so mysterious in its effects on human consciousness that the plant itself becomes a sacrament, deserving of humankind's worshipful care and dissemination. Such was the fate of Amanita muscaria among the Indo-Europeans, peyote among the American Indians, cannabis among the Hindus, Scythians, and Thracians, wine among the Greeks and early Christians. In the same way the human desire for beauty and sweetness introduced into the world a new survival strategy for the plants that could gratify it, the human hunger for transcendence created new opportunities for another group of plants. No entheogenic plant or fungus ever set out to make molecules for the express purpose of inspiring visions in humans. Combating pests is the far more likely motive. But the moment humans discovered what these molecules could do for them, this wholly inadvertent magic, the plants that made them suddenly had a brilliant new way to prosper. And from that moment on, this is exactly what the plants with the strongest magic did. Our desire for some form of transcendence of ordinary experience expresses itself not only in religion, but in other endeavors as well. And these, too, have probably been more deeply influenced by psychoactive plants than we like to think. Who knows? We may need a natural history of literature and philosophy, or of discovery and invention, to go on the shelf with our natural history of religion. Or maybe what we need is just a single volume, a natural history of the imagination. Somewhere in that volume, we would surely find a chapter on the place of the opium poppy and cannabis in the romantic imagination. It's well known that many English Romantic poets used opium, and several of the French Romantics experimented with hashish soon after Napoleon's troops brought it back with them from Egypt. What's harder to know is precisely what role these psychoactive plants may have played in the revolution in human sensibility we call Romanticism. The literary critic David Lenson, for one, believes it was crucial. He argues that Samuel Taylor Coleridge's notion of the imagination as a mental faculty that dissolves, diffuses, dissipates in order to recreate, an idea whose reverberations in Western culture haven't yet been stilled, simply cannot be understood without reference to the change in consciousness wrought by opium. This notion of secondary or transforming imagination established a model of artistic creativity in the West that lasted from 1815 until the fall of Saigon, Lenson writes. It is predicated on annihilating what Keats called weariness, fever, and fret, the world of fixed, dead objects, by just the sort of dissolution, diffusion, and dissipation that moves the artist toward the realms of accident, improvisation, and the unconscious. Not just romantic poetry, but modernism, surrealism, cubism, and jazz have all been nourished by Coleridge's idea of the transforming imagination, and that idea in turn was nourished by a psychoactive plant. However criticism has tried to sanitize this process, Lenson writes, we have to face the fact that some of our canonical poets and theorists, when apparently talking about imagination, are really talking about getting high. Sadie Plant, another literary critic, has argued that Coleridge's notion of the suspension of disbelief can also be traced to his use of opium. Curiously, the Romantics at first believed it was their philosophical rather than poetical faculties that drugs would enhance. Thomas de Quincey felt that opium would give a philosopher an inner eye and power of intuition for the vision and mysteries of our human nature. The 19th-century American writer Fitzhugh Ludlow reported an important encounter with a philosopher of antiquity while under the spell of hashish. All of which makes me wonder, is it possible that some of the philosophers of antiquity themselves had important encounters with magic plants? This, at least, was my first thought upon learning that many of the important thinkers of classical Greece, including Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, Aeschylus, and Euripides, had participated in the Mysteries of Eleusis. Nominally a harvest festival in honor of Demeter, the goddess of cultivated grains, the Mysteries were an ecstatic ritual during which participants consumed a powerful hallucinogenic potion. The precise recipe remains part of the mystery, but scholars speculate that the active ingredient was probably ergot, an alkaloid produced by a fungus, Claviceps purpurea, that infects cultivated grains and that closely resembles LSD in its chemical makeup and effects. Under the influence of this drug potion, the lights of classical civilization participated in a communal shamanic ritual of such mystery and transformative power that all who took part in it were sworn never to describe it. There is no way to know what, if anything, a philosopher or poet might have brought back from such a journey. But is it outlandish to ask whether such an experience might have helped inspire Plato's supernatural metaphysics? The belief that everything in our world has its true or ideal form in a second world beyond the reach of our senses? One of the things certain drugs do to our perceptions is to distance or estrange the objects around us, aestheticizing the most commonplace things until they appear as ideal versions of themselves. Under the spell of cannabis, every object stands more clearly for all of its class, as David Lenson writes in On Drugs. A cup looks like the Platonic idea of a cup. A landscape looks like a landscape painting. A hamburger stands for all the trillions of hamburgers ever served, and so forth. A psychoactive plant can open a door onto a world of archetypal forms, or so they can appear. Whether or not such a plant or fungus did this for Plato himself is, of course, impossible to ascertain, and somehow impious even to speculate on. But one could do worse, surely, searching for the spring of a metaphysics as visionary and strange as Plato's. The Platonic cup and the Coleridgean imagination are both memes, to use a term coined by the British zoologist Richard Dawkins in his 1976 book, The Selfish Gene. A meme is simply a unit of memorable cultural information. It can be as small as a tune or a metaphor, as big as a philosophy or a religious concept. Hell is a meme. So are the Pythagorean theorem, A Hard Day's Night, The Wheel, Hamlet, Pragmatism, Harmony, Where's the Beef, and of course the notion of the meme itself. Dawkins's theory is that memes are to cultural evolution what genes are to biological evolution. Unlike genes, however, memes have no physical basis. Memes are a culture's building blocks, passed down from brain to brain in a Darwinian process that leads, by trial and error, to cultural innovation and progress. The memes that prove themselves best adapted to their environment, that is, the ones that are most helpful for people to keep in their brains, are the ones most likely to survive and replicate and become widely regarded as good, true, or beautiful. Culture at any given moment is the meme pool in which we all swim, or rather, that swims through us. Cultural change occurs whenever a new meme is introduced and catches on. It might be romanticism or double-entry bookkeeping, chaos theory or Pokemon, or the notion of memes itself, which seems to be catching on today. So where in the world do new memes come from? Sometimes they spring full-blown from the brains of artists or scientists, advertising copywriters or teenagers. Often a process of mutation is involved in the creation of a new meme, in much the same way that mutations in the natural environment can lead to useful new genetic traits. Memes can mutate when they get combined in new ways, or when someone working with them makes a mistake, misreading or misinterpreting an old meme in such a way as to yield something new. For instance, besides being itself a new meme, Coleridge's transforming imagination has turned out to be an excellent technology for generating other new memes. When I read Dawkins, it occurred to me that his theory suggested a useful way to think about the effects of psychoactive plants on culture, the critical role they've played at various junctures in the evolution of religion and music. Think of jazz or rock improvisation, of poetry, philosophy, and the visual arts. What if these plant toxins function as a kind of cultural mutagen, not unlike the effect of radiation on the genome? They are, after all, chemicals with the power to alter mental constructs, to propose new metaphors, new ways of looking at things, and occasionally, whole new mental constructs. Anyone who uses them knows they also generate plenty of mental errors. Most such mistakes are useless or worse, but a few inevitably turn out to be the germs of new insights and metaphors. And the better part of Western literature, if literary theorist Harold Bloom's idea of creative misreading is to be believed. The molecules themselves don't add anything new to the stock of memes resident in a human brain, no more than radiation adds new genes. But surely the shifts in perception and breaks in mental habit they provoke are among the methods and models we have of imaginatively transforming mental and cultural givens, for mutating our inherited memes. At the risk of discrediting my own idea, I want to acknowledge that it owes a debt, how large I can't say, to a psychoactive plant. The notion that drugs might function as cultural mutagens occurred to me while reading The Selfish Gene while high on marijuana, which may or may not be an advisable thing to do. But whatever its value, it's at least a fresh idea, itself a kind of mutation of Dawkins's meme idea, and I seriously doubt it would have occurred to me had I not smoked a little pot the evening I was reading Dawkins. I wish I could say the same about the earlier speculation on Plato, but I'm afraid I was straight as a post for that one. I know. I said that I didn't much like smoking pot. But research is research, and besides, my personal relationship to cannabis underwent a sea change while I was in Amsterdam. I'd heard so much about the improvements made to marijuana that I felt I had to give it another try, and I promptly discovered that this pot, at least, left me feeling neither stupid nor paranoid. The non-stupid part can, I think, be accounted for by advances in cannabis breeding that make it possible to develop strains eliciting distinctly different mental effects. At the top end of the market, this has led to a connoisseurship of cannabis, not just of its taste or aroma, but of the specific psychological texture of its high. Some strains, typically those with a higher proportion of indica genes, are narcotic in their effects, tending to stupefy. Others, often the ones with more sativa genes, leave the mind clear and fluent and the body unimpaired. Some of the growers I met spoke in terms of white-collar and blue-collar pot. The strains I found personally sympathetic were stimulating and, evidently, conducive to mental speculation. As for the non-paranoid part, remember that I was in a country where one can smoke marijuana openly and without fear. The effect of the American drug war on the experience of smoking marijuana, a drug notoriously susceptible to the power of suggestion, cannot be overestimated. Writing in the Atlantic Monthly in 1966 about the intellectual uses of marijuana, now there's a topic that's moved beyond the pale. These days, one may speak of marijuana's medicinal uses, perhaps, but intellectual? Allen Ginsberg suggested that the negative feelings marijuana sometimes provokes, such as anxiety, fear, and paranoia, are traceable to the effects on consciousness not of the narcotic, but of the law. Researchers speak of set and setting as crucial factors shaping one's experience of any drug, and marijuana in particular almost unfailingly fulfills one's expectation of it, for better and worse. Lenson calls it the great yay-sayer, supporting whatever is going on anyway, and introducing little or nothing of its own. In my experience, cannabis can't reliably be used to change one's mood, only to intensify it. Smoking in a comfortable coffee shop with a dozen other people doing the same thing, I had no reason to feel paranoid, which is probably why I didn't. Taking account of this phenomenon, Andrew Weil describes marijuana as an active placebo. He contends that cannabis does not itself create, but merely triggers the mental state we identify as being high. The very same mental state, minus the physiological noise of the drug itself, can be triggered in other ways, such as meditation or breathing exercises. Weil believes it is an error of modern materialistic thinking to believe, as both drug users and drug researchers invariably do, that the high smoker's experience is somehow a product of the plant itself, or THC, rather than a creation of the mind. Prompted, perhaps, but sui generis. The truth of the matter is probably where it usually is, somewhere in the middle. Certainly, the psychological experience of marijuana is far too varied, not only from person to person, but from time to time, to be explained purely in terms of a chemical. At the same time, the chemistry of this particular plant surely has something specific to do with, say, the novel perceptions of Cézanne's pictorial space that Ginsberg describes in his Atlantic essay, the religious insights brought back by shamans, or even my own vagrant speculations on mutating memes. Opium would probably induce different kinds of thoughts in the same brains. We assume that there is some sort of cause and effect relationship between molecule and mind, but what it is, no one really knows. As the sorcerers, shamans, and alchemists who used them understood, psychoactive plants stand on the threshold of matter and spirit, at the point where simple distinctions between the two no longer hold. Consciousness is what we're talking about here, of course, and consciousness is precisely the frontier where our materialistic understanding of the brain stops, at least for the time being, but possibly forever. What's interesting about a plant like marijuana is that it takes us right up to that frontier and may have something to teach us about what lies on the other side. We tend to smile indulgently at poets like Allen Ginsberg for believing that cannabis is a useful tool for exploring consciousness. But it turns out, they may be right. In the mid-1960s, an Israeli neuroscientist named Raphael Mikulam identified the chemical compound responsible for the psychoactive effects of marijuana, delta-9-tetrahydrocannabinol, or THC, a molecule with a structure unlike any found in nature before or since. For years, Mikulam had been intrigued by the ancient history of cannabis as a medicine. A panacea in many cultures until its prohibition in the 1930s, it has been used to treat pain, convulsions, nausea, glaucoma, neuralgia, asthma, cramps, migraine, insomnia, and depression, and decided it might be worthwhile to isolate the plant's active ingredient. But it was the popularity of marijuana as a recreational drug in the 60s and the attendant official worries that freed up the resources to underwrite this kind of work, and a great deal of other cannabinoid research that, taken together, has yielded more knowledge about the workings of the human brain than anyone could have guessed. In 1988, Alan Howlett, a researcher at the St. Louis University Medical School, discovered a specific receptor for THC in the brain, a type of nerve cell that THC binds to like a molecular key in a lock, causing it to activate. Receptor cells form part of a neuronal network. The brain systems involving dopamine, serotonin, and the endorphins are three such networks. When a cell in a network is activated by its chemical key, it responds by doing a variety of things, sending a chemical signal to other cells, switching a gene on or off, or becoming more or less active. Depending on the network involved, this process can trigger cognitive, behavioral, or physiological changes. Howlett's discovery pointed to the existence of a new network in the brain. The cannabinoid receptors Howlett found showed up in vast numbers all over the brain, as well as in the immune and reproductive systems, though they were clustered in regions responsible for the mental processes that marijuana is known to alter: the cerebral cortex, the locus of higher order thought, the hippocampus, memory, the basal ganglia, movement, and the amygdala, emotions. Curiously, the one neurological address where cannabinoid receptors didn't show up was in the brainstem, which regulates involuntary functions such as circulation and respiration. This might explain the remarkably low toxicity of cannabis and the fact that no one is known to have ever died from an overdose. On the assumption that the human brain would not have evolved a special structure for the express purpose of getting itself high on marijuana, researchers hypothesized that the brain must manufacture its own THC-like chemical for some as-yet-unknown purpose. The scientific paradigm at work here was the endorphin system, which is tripped by opiates from plants as well as endorphins produced in the brain. In 1992, some 30 years after his discovery of THC, Raphael McCullum, working with a collaborator, William Devane, found it: the brain's own endogenous cannabinoid. He named it anandamide, from the Sanskrit word for inner bliss. Someday soon, McCullum and Howlett will almost surely receive the Nobel Prize, for their discoveries opened a new branch of neuroscience that promises to revolutionize our understanding of the brain and lead to a whole new class of drugs. Following on their work, neuroscientists are now busy trying to figure out exactly how the cannabinoid network works and why we should have one in the first place. I put that question to McCullum and Howlett and several of their colleagues in cannabinoid research, and their answers, while speculative, are richly suggestive. The cannabinoid network is unusually complex and varied in its functions, I learned, in part because it seems to modulate the action of other neurotransmitters, such as serotonin, dopamine, and the endorphins. When I asked Howlett what the purpose of such a network might be, she began her answer by listing some of the various direct and indirect effects of cannabinoids: pain relief, loss of short-term memory, sedation, and mild cognitive impairment. All of which is exactly what Adam and Eve would want after being thrown out of Eden. You couldn't design a more perfect drug for getting Eve through the pain of childbirth or helping Adam endure a life of physical toil. She noted that cannabinoid receptors had been found in the uterus of all places, and speculated that anandamide may not only dull the pain of childbirth, but help women forget it later. The sensation of pain is, curiously, one of the hardest to summon from memory. Howlett speculated that the human cannabinoid system evolved to help us endure and selectively forget the routine slings and arrows of life, so that we can get up in the morning and do it all over again. It is the brain's own drug for coping with the human condition. Raphael McCullum believes that the cannabinoid network is involved in regulating several different biological processes, including pain management, memory formation, appetite, the coordination of movement, and perhaps most intriguingly, emotion. We know next to nothing about the biochemistry of emotion, McCullum points out, but he thinks we'll eventually discover that cannabinoids are involved in the process by which the brain translates objective reality into subjective emotions. If I see my grandson rushing to meet me, I feel happy. How do I translate biochemically the objective reality of a grandson rushing toward me into the subjective change in my emotions? The brain's cannabinoids could be the missing link. So what are the odds that a molecule produced by a flower out in the world, by a weedy plant native to Central Asia, would turn out to hold the precise key required to unlock the neurological mechanism governing these aspects of human consciousness? There is something miraculous about such a correspondence between nature and mind, yet it must have a logical explanation. A plant does not go to the expense of making and continuing to make such a unique and complex molecule if it doesn't do the plant some evolutionary good. So why does cannabis produce THC? No one knows for sure, but botanists offer several competing theories, and most of them have nothing to do with getting people high, at least not at the plant's beginnings. The purpose of THC could be to protect cannabis plants from ultraviolet radiation. It seems that the higher the altitude at which cannabis grows, the more THC it produces. THC also exhibits antibiotic properties, suggesting a role in protecting cannabis from disease. Last, it's possible that THC gives the cannabis plant a sophisticated defense against pests. Cannabinoid receptors have been found in animals as primitive as the hydra, and researchers expect to find them in insects. Conceivably, cannabis produces THC to discombobulate the insects and higher herbivores that prey on the plant. It might make a bug, or a buck, or a rabbit forget what it's doing or where in the world it last saw that tasty plant. But whatever THC's purpose, it's unlikely that, as Raphael McCullum put it, a plant would produce a compound so that a kid in San Francisco can get high. Or is it? Robert Connell Clark, the marijuana botanist I met in Amsterdam, doesn't think that notion is quite as far-fetched as McCullum makes it sound. He finds most of the defense theories inadequate and concludes that the most obvious evolutionary advantage THC conferred on cannabis was the psychoactive properties, which attracted human attention and caused the plant to be spread around the world. Of course, McCullum and Clark could both be right. Whatever THC's original purpose may have been, as soon as a certain primate with a gift for experiment and horticulture stumbled on its psychoactive properties, the plant's evolution embarked on a new trajectory, guided from then on by that primate and his desires. The cannabis flowers that gave humans the most pleasure or strongest medicine were now the ones that produced the most offspring. What may have started out as a biochemical accident became the plant's co-evolutionary destiny, or at least one of its destinies, under domestication. Ma, the ancient Chinese character for hemp, depicts a male and a female plant under a roof. Cannabis inside the house of human culture. Cannabis was one of the earliest plants to be domesticated, probably for fiber first, then later as a drug. It has been co-evolving with humankind for more than 10,000 years, to the point where the aboriginal form of the plant may no longer exist. By now, cannabis is as much the product of human desire as a bourbon rose, and we have scant idea what the plant might have been like before it linked its destiny to our own. But what is so unusual about cannabis's co-evolution, compared to that of the rose, say, or the apple, is that it followed two such divergent paths down to our time, each reflecting the influence of a completely different human desire. Along the first path, which appears to have begun in ancient China and moved west toward northern Europe, then on to the Americas, the plant was selected by people for the strength and length of its fibers. Up until the last century, hemp was one of humankind's main sources of paper and cloth. Along the other path, which began somewhere in Central Asia and moved down through India, then into Africa, and from there across to the Americas with the slaves and up to Europe with Napoleon's army, cannabis was selected for its psychoactive and medicinal powers. 10,000 years later, hemp and cannabis are as different as night and day. Hemp produces negligible amounts of THC, and cannabis a worthless fiber. In the eyes of the U.S. government, however, there is still only one plant, so that the taboo on the drug plant has, pointlessly, doomed the fiber. It is hard to conceive of a domesticated plant more plastic than cannabis, a single species answering to two such different desires, the first more or less spiritual in nature, and the other, quite literally, material. The scientists I talked to had a lot to say about the descent and biochemistry of cannabis, but about the plant's effects on our experience of consciousness, they were all but silent. What I wanted to know is, what exactly does it mean, biologically, to say a person is high? When I put this question to Alan Howlett, her answer consisted of two rather parched words: cognitive dysfunction. Cognitive dysfunction? Okay, but isn't that a little like saying that having sex elevates one's pulse? It's perfectly true as far as it goes, but it doesn't get you any closer to the heart of the matter, or to the desire. John Morgan, a pharmacologist who has written widely about marijuana, points out that we don't yet understand consciousness scientifically, so how can we hope to explain changes in consciousness scientifically? McCullum replied to my questions about what it means biochemically to be high simply by saying, "I am afraid we have to leave these questions still to the poets." So there, it seemed, the neuroscientists had stranded me, all on my unscientific own with a dime bag and the dubious company of poets such as Allen Ginsberg and Charles Baudelaire, Fitzhugh Ludlow and, yikes, Carl Sagan. But Carl Sagan wearing his goofiest non-scientific hat. You see, I'd discovered that in 1971, Sagan had anonymously published an earnest, marvelous account of his experiences with pot, which he credited with devastating insights about the nature of life. "There is a myth about such highs," Sagan wrote. "The user has an illusion of great insight, but it does not survive scrutiny in the morning. I am convinced that this is an error, and that the devastating insights achieved while high are real insights. The main problem is putting these insights in a form acceptable to the quite different self that we are when we're down the next day. If I find in the morning a message from myself the night before informing me that there is a world around us which we barely sense, or that we can become one with the universe, or even that certain politicians are desperately frightened men, I may tend to disbelieve. But when I'm high, I know about this disbelief. And so I have a tape in which I exhort myself to take such remarks seriously. I say, 'Listen closely, you son of a bitch of the morning. This stuff is real.'" Sagan's essay, attributed to Mr. X, appears in Marijuana Reconsidered by Lester Grinspoon. After Sagan's death in 1996, Grinspoon revealed Mr. X's identity. Yet as I proceeded with my literary and phenomenological investigations of the pot experience, I soon realized I had gotten something valuable from the scientists after all. They had inadvertently pointed me in the direction of a deeper understanding of what it is that cannabis does to human consciousness, and what possibly it has to teach us about it. In fact, Howlett was probably right, if inelegant, in her simple formulation, because I've come to think that a cognitive dysfunction of a very special kind does, in fact, lie at the heart of it. Let me try to explain. The scientists I spoke to were unanimous in citing short-term memory loss as one of the key neurological effects of the cannabinoids. In their own way, so were the poets who tried to describe the experience of cannabis intoxication. All talk about the difficulty of reconstructing what happened mere seconds ago, and what a Herculean challenge it becomes to follow the thread of a conversation, or a passage of prose, when one's short-term memory isn't operating normally. Yet the scientists said that the THC in cannabis is only mimicking the actions of the brain's own cannabinoids. What a curious thing this is for a brain to do, to manufacture a chemical that interferes with its own ability to make memories. And not just memories of pain, either. So I emailed Raphael McCullum to ask him why he thought the brain might secrete a chemical that has such an undesirable effect. "Don't be so sure that forgetting is undesirable," he suggested. "Do you really want to remember all the faces you saw on the New York City subway this morning?" McCullum's somewhat oblique comment helped me begin to appreciate that forgetting is vastly underrated as a mental operation. Indeed, that it is a mental operation rather than, as I'd always assumed, strictly the breakdown of one. Yes, forgetting can be a curse, especially as we age. But forgetting is also one of the more important things healthy brains do, almost as important as remembering. Think how quickly the sheer volume and multiplicity of sensory information we receive every waking minute would overwhelm our consciousness if we couldn't quickly forget a great deal more of it than we remember. At any given moment, my senses present to my consciousness, this perceiving I, a blizzard of data no human mind can completely absorb. To illustrate the point, let me try to capture here a few drops of this perceptual cataract, preserve one cross-section of the routinely forgotten. Right now, my eyes, even without moving, offer the following. Directly in front of me, the words I'm typing on a computer screen, along with its blue background and tumble of icons. Peripherally, there's the blonde wood grain of my desk, a mouse pad, printed with words and images, a CD spinning red in its little window, two bookshelves crammed with a couple of dozen spines I could easily read but don't, a gray plastic heater grate, a blue folder entitled Pot Clips stuck into a standing file at an annoying angle, two hands with an unspecified number of flying fingers, Band-Aid on one hand, glint of gold on the other, one jeans-clad lap, two green-sweatered wrists, a window, its green muntins framing a boulder with lichens, dozens of trees, hundreds of branches, millions of leaves, and, drawing a soft border around 90% of this visual field, the metal frames of my eyeglasses. And that's just my eyes. My sense of touch, meanwhile, presents to my attention a low background drone of shoulder ache, a slight burning sensation in the tip of my right middle finger, where it was cut the other day, and the cool rush of air through my nostrils. Taste? Black tea and bergamot, Earl Grey, slightly briny breakfast residue on tongue, smoked salmon. Soundtrack? Red Hot Chili Peppers in the foreground, backed by heater whoosh on the right, computer cooling fan whoosh on the lower left, mouse clicks, keyboard clatter, creak crack of those knuckle-like things deep in the neck when I cant my head to one side, and then outside, a scatter of birdsong, methodical drips on the roof, and the slow sky tear of a propeller plane. Smell. Lemon pledge, mixed with woodsy damp. I won't even try to catalog the numberless errant thoughts presently nipping around the writing of this paragraph like a flittering school of fish. Or maybe I will. Second thoughts and misgivings arriving in waves, shoving crowds of alternative words and grammatical constructions, shimmering lunch options, small black holes of consciousness from which I try to fish out metaphors, a clamoring handful of to-dos, a spongy awareness of the time till lunch, and so on and so on. If we could hear the squirrel's heartbeat, the sound of the grass growing, we should die of that roar, George Eliot once wrote. Our mental health depends on a mechanism for editing the moment-by-moment ocean of sensory data flowing into our consciousness down to a manageable trickle of the noticed and remembered. The cannabinoid network appears to be part of that mechanism, vigilantly sifting the vast chaff of sense impression from the kernels of perception we need to remember if we're to get through the day and get done what needs to be done. McCullum thinks we'll eventually find a neurotransmitter that does for remembering what the cannabinoids do for forgetting, and that the push and pull interaction of these two chemicals together determines what is filed in memory and what is thrown out. The THC in marijuana and the brain's endogenous cannabinoids work in much the same way, but THC is far stronger and more persistent than anandamide, which, like most neurotransmitters, is designed to break down very soon after its release. Chocolate, of all things, seems to slow this process, which might account for its own subtle mood-altering properties. What this suggests is that smoking marijuana may overstimulate the brain's built-in forgetting faculty, exaggerating its normal operations. This is no small thing. Indeed, I would venture that more than any other single quality, it is the relentless moment-by-moment forgetting. This draining of the pool of sense impression almost as quickly as it fills that gives the experience of consciousness under marijuana its peculiar texture. It helps account for the sharpening of sensory perceptions, for the aura of profundity in which cannabis bathes the most ordinary insights, and perhaps most important of all, for the sense that time has slowed or even stopped. For it is only by forgetting that we ever really drop the thread of time and approach the experience of living in the present moment, so elusive in ordinary hours. And the wonder of that experience, perhaps more than any other, seems to be at the very heart of the human desire to change consciousness, whether by means of drugs or any other technique. Consider the cattle grazing as they pass you by. Friedrich Nietzsche begins a brilliant, somewhat eccentric 1876 essay he called The Uses and Disadvantages of History for Life. They do not know what is meant by yesterday or today. They leap about, eat, rest, digest, leap about again, and so from morn till night and from day to day, fettered to the moment and its pleasure or displeasure, and thus neither melancholy nor bored. A human being may well ask an animal, "Why do you not speak to me of your happiness, but only stand and gaze at me?" The animal would like to answer and say, "The reason is I always forget what I was going to say." But then he forgot this answer too, and stayed silent. The first part of Nietzsche's essay is a moving and occasionally hilarious paean to the virtues of forgetting, which he maintains is a prerequisite to human happiness, mental health, and action. Without dismissing the value of memory or history, he argues, much like Emerson and Thoreau, that we spend altogether too much of our energy laboring in the shadows of the past, under the stultifying weight of convention, precedent, received wisdom, and neurosis. Like the American transcendentalists, Nietzsche believes that our personal and collective inheritance stands in the way of our enjoyment of life and accomplishment of anything original. Cheerfulness, the good conscience, the joyful deed, confidence in the future, all of them depend on one's being just as able to forget at the right time as to remember. He admonishes us to cast off the great and ever greater pressure of what is past and live instead rather more like the child, or the cow, that plays in blissful blindness between the hedges of past and future. Nietzsche acknowledges that there are perils to inhabiting the present. One is liable to falsely suppose all his experiences are original to him, but any loss in knowingness or sophistication is more than made up for by the gain in vigor. For Nietzsche, the art and power of forgetting consist in a kind of radical editing or blocking out of consciousness everything that doesn't serve the present purpose. A man seized by a vehement passion or great idea will be blind and deaf to all except that passion or idea. Everything he does perceive, however, he will perceive as he has never perceived anything before. All is so palpable, close, highly colored, resounding, as though he apprehended it with all his senses at once. What Nietzsche is describing is a kind of transcendence, a mental state of complete and utter absorption well known to artists, athletes, gamblers, musicians, dancers, soldiers in battle, mystics, meditators, and the devout during prayer. Something very like it can occur during sex, too, or while under the influence of certain drugs. It is a state that depends for its effect on losing oneself in the moment, usually by training a powerful, depthless concentration on one big thing. Or, in the Eastern tradition, one big nothing. If you imagine consciousness as a kind of lens through which we perceive the world, the drastic constricting of its field of vision seems to heighten the vividness of whatever remains in the circle of perception, while everything else, including our awareness of the lens itself, simply falls away. Some of our greatest happinesses arrive in such moments, during which we feel as though we've sprung free from the tyranny of time. Clock time, of course, but also historical.